listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Now from the Nowcast Network studios, here's Mike.
Hey, welcome to the Audio Nowcast. My name is Mike Rodriguez, and before we get going, let me introduce the guys. Over here on my right, we've got the one and only Diego Stecco.
Hey, Mike.
Next to him, we've got Brandon Birdsong.
How you doing, Mike?
And across the table, we've got the one and only, I'm not going to say Iron Man.
No, we played that out.
Yes.
But you got to say something else because you said the one and only for me. So
how about the oldest guy in the room?
Rob Arbus here.
Hello, Mike.
Guys, this is show number 88. Woo! 88, and we're down to the four of us.
And then there were four.
And then there were four. Although I did get an email from Bill, and he's settling in his new digs.
Oh,
and
nice. Cool.
He should be joining us pretty soon via Skype on the podcast. So
awesome. Cool.
We just lost his face. We didn't lose him.
Nice.
Joining us today, we have, a really good friend of mine that I've worked with several times, but believe it or not, today was the first time we actually met in person, and that's Brian Mann from Man Made Music.
Hi, Brian.
Thank you.
We've literally done like a dozen projects together, and I talked to him on the phone, but I've never met him in person. Yeah. So rude of you.
Huh?
No, it just kind of tells you how technology
is
nowadays.
That's the new paradigm.
You know, and I know people who've worked with other people and only talk to them on email. So it's not uncommon. But anyhow, Brian, thank you for joining us. And we're going to talk a little bit on the second half. We're going to talk more about, we'll find out more about Brian and Mammy Music and also talk about animation and composing for animation and how that's a little bit of a different challenge than composing for live action. But before we do that, a couple things that I want to talk about. First of all, the Audio Nowcast is a podcast where we talk about everything related to the audio industry, and we're all professionals here, and we all give our opinion, and be they right or wrong, they're our opinion.
Absolutely.
But I wanted to talk about a few things. Number one is, guys, I did something last week that I never thought I would do, and I hope I don't offend people out there, but I went to a country music concert.
Wow.
I am offended right here.
Wow.
And worse yet, I actually enjoyed it.
Oh, wow. You bought a t-shirt as well. I'm sure you
did. I did not buy a t-shirt.
But you got something.
No, but actually.
Or a belt buckle or something.
Right. I went to see Martina McBride because I've interviewed John McBride before and through some context got into the concert. And let me tell you. That band, man, first of all, she's a great singer. Mm-hmm. She really is good. John McBride actually mixes her. He's her husband, but he's also the front house mixer. So that should have some interesting, you know, conversations there, you know?
Yeah, especially if there's feedback during the show. Like, what was that about?
What did you say?
Do that at home.
Right.
But it was great. It was a great show. The band was tight. It sounded really awesome.
A little bit.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that.
A little steel.
But it was, you know, it really made me think about, you know, I had all these prejudices against different types of music and things like that. And, you know, if you just go and open your mind and try something new, you'd be surprised. You might
I can recommend some country shows that'll give you those prejudices right back. You happen to go to a good one.
You were just lucky.
All right. Well,
you can get those back for you. No time.
Rob, thanks for just being you, okay?
I'm just saying it like it is.
Well, I can only tell you this. I watched the Crazy Heart, the film,
right.
And I enjoyed it.
That was a good film.
Yeah. And it's based on country music as well.
You know, they can. When I was listening to country, it was funny because, you know, country has a lot of its base is, you know, you hear a lot of R&B riffs, you hear a lot of, even rock and roll, a lot of the modern stuff. I think the only thing that really kind of separates it is when that steel guitar comes in.
Of course.
You know, you think of that steel guitar, you're down country lane.
Yeah,
you
of
know?
Course.
But it was a great show. She can sing. It's so good to hear a real vocalist. It's just really refreshing to hear someone who can sing who's just, you know, not processed and has a great band. Everybody's playing live. It's a really cool show. So, Everybody except Rob, go see that show.
Hey, I don't mind country music some of the time. I actually used to do a ton of country music. I used to do all the ads for the Country Music Awards on CBS.
Really?
Like year after year.
Yeah!
And it was always the same announcer guy. I remember he came over and he's like, you know, 6'10 with a giant cowboy hat on. Where do I step up to the mic? And he'd come in and he'd read off all his names. This year, Reba McEntire. He'd read his names and we'd do this twangy music behind him. And there used to be budgets for things like that, and it was fun.
Yeah. All right. Well, anyhow, I feel like I just had to confess that. So.
No, compared to some of the stuff you've told us you've done, that's not so
that's
crazy.
That's nothing. Seriously.
Anyway, well, let's just get right into it. The first thing I want to talk about today is headphones. Headphones, the unsung hero of the studio. And this is actually a request by one of the listeners out there, Jack Broad. And Jack wanted us to have a discussion on headphones, and I thought that was really a great idea because we all use them all the time, every day. And you know, headphones are one of those things that once you like a certain pair or a certain kind, you tend to stick with it. You don't change too often. And so I'm going to open it up. Let's start with you, Diego. And your
does he have any specific question? Or
no, he just said talk about headphones. And uh-huh. There's some things that I want to bring up about the different types of headphones and closed cans versus open cans and when you're playing a guitar and how do you monitor things
right.
like that. But let's just start with you. Tell us about your headphones.
I don't even know the name of the headphones that I use because I don't like them as a principle because they just alter the sound so much. But they are useful, of course, when you're recording.
How do they alter the sound?
There's just way too much I hand. And it's not the real sound that you would hear through the speakers. So what I hear through the headphones is right. not what I hear after. So I don't really trust the headphones. I never use them for a mix, for example. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that I love to have a good pair of very tight headphones when I'm recording at very low volumes.
Right.
Because they allow me to hear everything, including my breath, if I am recording mm-hmm. stuff that are so quiet. And there's no spill, which is the most important thing. So even though I don't really like them, I consider them an essential part of everyday, you know, work in a studio, live, or anything.
What about headphones? Like, if you try to pair headphones, what would you immediately hate? What would be the one thing that, like, nope?
Well, how they fit, how you feel them around, because right. if you have to carry them for a long time, like for 3-4 hours,
right.
that's an important issue.
Right.
Probably even more important than the sound. But after that, you know, as you said, once you find a pair that works well,
right.
you tend to stick with them unless they don't sell them anymore or, mm-hmm. or if there's something that is phenomenally better than that.
Right.
But
Brandon, what about you, headphones?
I have several sort of low-end pairs of headphones, nothing too expensive or fancy. Comfort is a big deal. I mean, I don't do any final mixing on headphones, but I think I have a couple pairs of Sennheiser, just like, you know, $100 pairs or something that aren't that special, but they get the job done. They're comfortable, and when I need them, I use them, and that's that.
What about you, Brian? What kind of headphones do you use?
Well, I think I've got some AKGs, the ones that shed black stuff
240s.
All over you.
Yeah. The 240s. Right.
And so it leaves a trail, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, and they're you know, they're bass shy and kind of a lot of mid-range and all that, not too accurate tonally, so I certainly couldn't mix tonally with them. They're good for hearing left-right, making sure I know what's going on there. Tom Dowd used to mix with these electrostatic headphones,
right.
and I don't remember what they were, but he had a... Yeah, the power supply was like a big box. Like this.
They could have been ear speakers, because ear speakers being an electrostatic headphone that actually, I think I know, that kind of pointed in towards your ears, and they were big and flat and had its own power supply.
I remembered the brand, because it was remarkable, because I hadn't seen anybody do that before.
And they're expensive. They were wickedly expensive.
Yeah.
What about you, Rob? What about you? Let's talk.
Funny, for in the studio, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago or more, I bought a bunch of Sony, just typical studio headphones, and I still have them. I mean,
like
they don't
V6s?
All still work. Yeah, I think they were V6s. They don't all still work, and some of the foam has dried up and fallen apart, but most of them do still work, and I still use them in the studio because they sound fine. In a studio, it's most important to me that they don't have that much bleed, so I don't like using open headphones in the studio. You want as little bleed as possible. I do have some one-ear headphones because for certain singers and certain musicians, it's good to just have one ear on to help with their intonation, and you don't want to have the other ear just sort of flapping loose because then you get bleed. Something that we should cover that we've actually experienced here on the podcast is that something that can make a huge difference on the same pair of headphones is different amplifiers.
Yeah.
And a lot of the cheap headphone amps that people use really can't handle the power to deliver the right bass, and you get a lot of distortion and things just don't sound really good. You can take the same pair of headphones and plug them into a really good headphone amp, like the ones we're using here, the Aphexes.
Oh, yeah, they're phenomenal.
The HeadPods. And then it's just like it's a different pair of headphones.
Well, I think that's a good point you bring up about powering them correctly, because the 240s, the AKG 240
amps, suck a lot of power.
You need to really drive them. If you want them to sound great, drive them. I know Martin in his studio, we're driving his headphone splitters. That's run by a Crown 250, just a 250 amp going
just for
just for headphones.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
They sound great, and it's plenty of volume, but you definitely need to drive them pretty hard.
Because headphones, you know, to move bass, even though it's a much smaller speaker than the big woofer in your monitors, it still needs a lot of power to drive that properly.
Well, I do mix on headphones. I mix on headphones quite a lot. And headphones, I'm always buying headphones, especially earbuds. I buy a ton of earbuds because I haven't found a pair that I've fallen in love with. The ones that actually, here's a couple things with earbuds. There's a lot of hype out there with earbuds, and there's a lot of, like, you want the multi-drivers and you want all this little stuff, and they're going to charge a lot of money. I have some expensive earbuds, and quite frankly, I don't want to alienate all these earbud manufacturers, but a lot of it is a lot of hype. It's the money that you're going to pay for the sound difference. You know, you're going to pay, you know, 75% more for a 20% increase. Now, if that's in your budget,
there was a case when I paid some money for earbuds, but the sound was so pumped. Yeah. It was so artificial. You couldn't really use them.
And that's the thing with the multi-driver earbuds. I found that it's so important to, A, you got to have it on your bone in your ear the correct way so that you can get a little bit of that bass. But the other thing, too, is they're not always consistent, because you do a micro little change in the fit of the earbud in your ear, and it's going to change your tone.
You know, the whole multi-driver thing, too. I mean, you only need one eardrum to pick up lows, mids, and highs. Yeah. So why do you need three drivers a millimeter away?
Yeah, and
because the packaging looks much better.
I think so.
I have an $80 pair of Sonys where basically the design is take a Walkman large, you know, bud, and cover that the part of the earbud up, and on the side of it put a little port, and then put that in your ear, and that's basically a design, and it's great. They're great because you have that big diaphragm to get bass, right, and then you can still get all the highs and the mids. And I paid $80 for them, and they sound fantastic for an $80 pickup. And I was in one of those airport electronic stores, and I was looking, and this guy, you know, I was on a gig and had some extra per diem, and so, you know, you got to spend it because you're going home. You don't go home with per diem.
Of course.
It's almost illegal.
They take it
right?
back.
That's right. So I had some per diem, and so I went into the store, and I was going to get some
he's confessing earbuds. Everything. I'm telling you.
And this guy was trying to convince me on one of the bigger brands on their earbuds, and, you know, you got to listen to this, you got to listen to that. So I said, okay. And so I put it in, and they didn't sound good at all. He goes, no, jam them way in there, jam them way in there. And so I'm like jamming them way in there. And it's like, and first I'm thinking, you know, if I got to go through all this to get my earbuds to sound decent, forget it.
Well, you know what? You know? If you're telling me that we can't trust an airport electronics salesman, then I'm going to lose all faith in the auto industry.
Right.
Who are we supposed to trust?
I'm just showing an example of it's just, you know, just a lot of hype out there, and you don't have to spend that kind of money. I will say that I found, you know, I found when I mix, I like to mix with headphones, not in earbuds, for one thing, because the headphones will pretty much always be on your head the same way. And then you just got to remember a couple things when you're mixing with headphones. You got to realize that your imaging is going to be way bigger in your head than what your speakers are going to be. So just be aware of your imaging, and also be aware of your center, because the center channel in a headphone, you're going to hear it a lot more than you would in a speaker. So what will end up happening is you think you're mixing your vocal in a really nice sweet spot, and you put it in the speaker, and the vocals, it's not there. So I think once you start to understand what your sound is going to be like in the headphones versus your speakers, then you'll be able to start doing a little bit more intelligent mixing. It's actually not a bad way to mix, because you can actually hear into the mix on a lot of things that if you don't have really good monitors, it's hard to hear. Like, you can hear into the reverbs, you can hear the tails and things of that nature.
The trick with mixing on headphones or speakers or anything else is listen to stuff that you know the sound of and that you like the sound of.
Right.
Figure out what that sounds like on whatever you're listening on, headphones or speakers, and then become really accustomed to it, and then you can mix freely on that.
Right, because headphones, they absolutely will color your sound, and once you know what the color is, then you can work around it. Like, the headphones I'm wearing right now are actually one of my favorite pairs to mix with, and they're the Bose, the smaller on-ear Quiet Comforts, but they are just bass hyped. So you just know you're going to get a ton of bass on that. So what's going to end up happening is when you mix, if you're not aware of that bass, the hypeness of that bass, then you're going to tend to cut back on the bass a little bit, and then you're going to play it on your system, and you're just going to go, where's the bass? So just know that, you know, so I know when I mix on here, I want it pumping. I want to hear that bass, and I want to hear it hard and heavy, because I'll be able to transfer it into my speakers at a pretty, you know, reasonable level.
I gotta say, we do not mix on headphones for that reason, because I don't like having to listen knowing how I'm going to have to change the sound to accommodate, you know, what I'm listening on. I'd rather just hear it right the first way.
And you know what? I absolutely agree with you.
Just a different approach.
No, it's not even that, it's so much that. It's like sometimes I'm mixing and I have like a quick deadline and I have to have the files turned around. Really, I did a Skechers commercial, did the whole thing in a coffee shop because they needed it right then and there. I couldn't get to a studio, had my headphones, had my little Pro Tool system, got the QuickTime, they emailed me the QuickTime. Everything was pre-recorded. I did the sound effects, mixed the music, did the whole thing, headphones, coffee shop, boom, shot it back up. It was gone. It was done. And it was only because...
Oh, definitely for those situations.
Yeah,
I
was mobile
and
I can kind of do that. I mean, I would rather be, you know, working on my S3As than the Quiet Comfort 2.
You know?
But sometimes you got to do what you got
to
do.
Most clients can wait for you to get back to the studio. Most don't need you to, like, pull the car over and do the mix, you know, before you get to the next traffic light.
Yeah.
But you have some very demanding clients.
Well, you know, the thing is I live quite a ways from my studio. Oh,
that's true.
You know, I didn't want to drive all the way back up.
But I remember that was a day many years ago. I was composing a radio jingle at the train station with Pro Tools. Yes.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And I had headphones. No, actually, I had the iPod headphones on.
Right.
But I wasn't mixing.
I was just
composing. So it was just to hear what I was doing.
Sometimes late at night. I mean, if you just want to be in a different environment and you want to be inspired by something, you know, if you're in a hotel room or someplace, sometimes you just want to work on something and you can't get to your speakers. Headphones aren't a bad way to go.
And a lot of times we'll mix on speakers and then just check it in headphones.
Yeah. Well,
because you can hear detail. You might not. No, we never do the vice versa. We never mix on headphones and check it on speakers.
Yeah, it's amazing. You hear little pops and clicks.
Yeah, you can hear a little detail that you might not have heard on your speakers.
I'll tell you what, doing 5-1 in headphones is a little difficult.
I would
no, I'm just kidding. Brian, you ever mix anything on headphones before?
No, I always do listen on. I was just thinking though, with you know, depends on what you're mixing for,
right?
The medium. So for songs, most people listen to songs now on earbuds.
Yeah,
true.
That's true.
And so I'm just wondering, because I hadn't looked into that too much, but I'm wondering if you guys ever think about that and mixing with earbuds, because the song, not for broadcast so much, but maybe that too.
Well, following this kind of concept, I started listening my stuff on the speakers of the laptop. Mm-hmm. Because that's another...
You always have to check and make some laptop speakers now.
So in theory, if it sounds good also on those cheap speakers, it's good. So
I've
think
had
the
clients
principle.
Where they say, you know, they make a complaint about the music. And I say, well, how are you listening to it? And a lot of times they are listening on the little laptop speakers. And so I think it's a good thing to check your mixes on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I like that because the speakers of the laptop has some physical limits. Mm-hmm. So it's not like the speakers on your studio can just bring the volume up and down, and somehow they have more flexibility to, you know, allow some colorations. The speakers of the computer, they just distort. When mm-hmm. you hit the resonant frequency, that's it. So you know that you got to stay below that.
Right.
And that's somehow, it's, I don't want to say it's a reference, but somehow this physical limit gives you a stop. It's like not more than, mm-hmm. not more dBs here, because they can't be...
But you don't do your primary mixing.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, that's true. I will say, I've done things where I've mixed on speakers, and then you put the headphone mix on, and it only sounds better.
The sound of the piano, okay? If you play it through the speakers of the laptop, mm-hmm. sometimes you can hear distortions on some peak frequencies, yeah. which mm-hmm. you wouldn't hear on your...
On good speakers.
Yeah, because you just hear the richness of the sound, but mm-hmm. on these little speakers, they just clip.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you one thing that comes across on headphones that you can that really tell is like bad compression. Mm. Like bad compression on headphones just almost hurt me. You know, just you feel that pumping and you feel like
because the dynamic is altered in your headphones. So.
Yeah, it's that hurts.
Don't turn your earbuds up too loud. There's a massive problem with the whole generation going deaf.
Well, let's segue then from headphones. Let's talk about monitors.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
All right. Yeah.
They're a lot harder to strap to the side of your head.
I went to go pick up a pair of monitors, bookshelf-sized monitors, and I just went over to the local guitar center, and I wanted to hear the monitors. And first of all, that was a mistake because they weren't set up so I could hear them. But when I finally did get them to, plug some stuff up, I just noticed there's a broad range of really good speakers nowadays. Well, and some really bad speakers nowadays in that $1,000 a pair and below market. And so I just wanted to get your guys' opinion on that segment. You know, all of us have our own set of really nice speakers that we monitor off of, whether it's the Atoms or the Genelex. But I'm talking about, the bookshelf size speakers, like the BX5As on the low end and the Atom A7s on the high end and in there. Thoughts?
Well, I mean, all of the speakers, because not too long ago, I was looking for something in that range just for a little production room I was setting up. And I just wanted to throw something in there that wasn't that expensive.
Right.
And the truth is, if you're used to really good speakers, then all of those speakers fall short and are hyped in weird frequency ranges and basically sound like crap compared to really good speakers. It is definitely true that M-Audio and Mackie and some of these companies have redefined what a $400 or $500 speaker is. It's way better than it used to be.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
But it's still not great. And the trick is, any speaker you're going to get in that kind of price range is going to be hyped someplace. A lot of times they hype the bass so that it sounds like a more expensive speaker, or so you don't feel like you need to buy a sub.
Well, and that's if you're lucky, because a lot of those speakers, what they call hyped bass is barely bass at all.
Well, it's just a weird hump.
It's a bass reflex thing.
Yeah. You know, and they're doing it for very cheap, and it's better than nothing, definitely. But if you're going to be mixing on those kinds of speakers, you better really listen to stuff that you can also hear on great speakers occasionally or on headphones or something to hear how those speakers are hyped. Because like BX5As, is that what it is? They're great for the price, but they're not very accurate speakers. It doesn't mean you can't get work done on inaccurate speakers, but learn their personality. Learn what it is they do to the sound.
I mean, look at the NS10s and all the great music that was mixed on those guys. You know, those were not great sounded speakers.
Yeah. Definitely not, but they weren't as artificially humped the way the new generation of cheap speakers are.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a natural hump because of their drivers.
I'll tell you what people don't realize, too, because you always hear the NS10 argument being brought up and against some of the modern speakers that you have out here, like the BX5As and those. And I happen to really like the BX5As. But what people don't realize is a lot of those studios that they had the NS10s in, they had great freaking amplifiers powering
Absolutely.
Those things.
Yeah, that's the trick with those speakers.
And that's the whole
key. It's a trick with most speakers.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's not so much the speakers, it's what's driving the mm-hmm. speakers. And you can hear, like, some of the cheaper Chinese ones where, you know, they have what looks like all the right elements, but they're going to drive it from a little 10-watt little amplifier.
Well, and the whole self-powered speaker thing, it's very convenient and it makes things easy, but usually the amplifier is the cheapest part of the whole thing because that's not – when you see it in the store, you're not seeing the amplifier.
Right.
No, you look at
the speaker. It looks like a cool speaker.
Right.
It's true. The amps that are powering some of these things are just like little toys.
Yeah, I mean, you might be better off if you're going to find a really high-end, you know, you want to mix on bookshelf speakers, get a nice passive speaker and put some money into an amp. You know, it can't hurt if you got a good amp.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mix on, Brian? What's your speaker?
You don't want to say.
Exclusively on BX5A.
Sponsored by M Audio.
He has BX5A on the left and headphones on the right.
No, I'm gonna be the lamb to slaughter, but Mackie 8 HR8 whatever they are, the 8-inch Mackies. I've been using them for several years. They're okay.
But those weren't that cheap, were they?
I don't know. It was $1,000 or
$1,200. Yeah, they're a level higher than these.
I don't know those others.
Yeah, Mackies, they were the ones inspired by Genelec, I think, and they were pretty good actually.
But I hear the difference when I listen to Genelec, and I'm just cheap, you know. And I got used to it.
Oh, smart.
Well, the other trick is, you know, would my clients be able to tell the difference in a million years? You know, mm-hmm. when we have to make a lot of decisions based on that too.
Yeah.
The answer is no, usually.
Yeah. What about you, Brandon?
I was actually in the market for some new monitors. I was talking to Rob about it at dinner tonight, and I'm looking at the Genelec 8030s or 8040s.
That's a good choice.
Yeah.
They're pretty great.
A lot of good reviews about both of those. The 8030 is like $700-$740 a piece.
In that price range, actually a little less, you should check out the Atom A7s though. They're pretty good, I will say. I was just a wallet credit card shy of actually buying that set right then and there.
Are those powered?
You know, they're powered, yeah, uh-huh. And they're Atoms, and the Atoms make a smaller set, and of all the ones that I heard that day, they were just, boom, they popped the most, and
really?
they have that ribbon tweeter, and Atoms really, they really know how to do the high end really well. Mm. It's just, it's very smooth. It's a very fast speaker. You can hear the transients, you know, you can hear the hit. That's sometimes the smaller bookshelf speakers, you don't hear those fast transients. They get a little muddy. And this one was nice and tight. And I have having the S3As, I'm just used to fast attacks. I'm sure the Genelecs are good because I like Genelecs too. So,
but Mike, if I was to get something, you know, in that price range, would you recommend getting the passive ones and getting an amp or, what do you recommend?
Well,
do you think those are good enough on their own?
I go by what you hear. I mean, I like the A7s. I mean, I spent some time listening to them, and only because I'm really familiar with the whole Atom sound. And you know what? Don't be fooled. Manufacturers have their own sound. You know, Atoms sound like Atoms. JBLs sound like JBLs. Genelecs have a Genelec sound.
And in that price range, they are matching the amps with the speakers pretty well.
Yeah.
They're not trying to do everything for a dollar. You know, there is some cost put into those.
Yeah, that's going to cost you about $1,000 for a pair, you know, so they're not cheap. They're not going up against like the BX5As or any of the smaller ones.
No, it's a different league once you get up to there.
But they sound great. They sound really good if you like that.
Well, another thing I told Brandon at the same dinner is one of the most important things with any of these speakers is that when you get them, that you set them upright.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you take a pair, you can take a pair of really expensive Genelecs out of the box, put them on your table, and they may not sound
good.
By the
way, I bought I don't remember the name, those things that you put under the speaker. It's like a piece of solid material.
Yeah. A Genelec, a little razor?
Yeah, I don't remember the name.
No, I know.
They look like those things that you have there.
Right, right.
But they make such a big difference.
Yeah.
Huge difference. I drove myself crazy with platforms to put the speakers on. And I ended up, when I had my current studio furniture built, I ended up having in the bridge that holds the speakers, there are actually these 4-inch thick troughs
right.
that are then filled with concrete and rubber and car door insulation foam and granite and all these different
yep.
layers, and it makes an unbelievable difference. And you can take the same speakers, put them on that, and then the speakers sit on carbon yep. fiber cones too, so they're really isolated. And Mike has sort of stolen the idea for
yeah,
these platforms in here.
I have totally... And it works. That little... And let me explain what we're looking at. Basically, I went and bought a brick, one of those... that you would lay for a sidewalk, and it's
a paver.
12
yeah,
inch,
it's like a paver.
Like yeah, like a paving brick, and it's like 12 by 12 by like 2.5 inches thick, and it's just really solid. And on top of that, I put a Prime Acoustic, the pads, and it totally isolates my speaker stand from the speaker, and it just lets the speaker sing, and you don't have
and
any...
And you saved a heck of a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. The bass make a big difference.
But I did get it. I totally stole it from the studio.
I know you did. I
totally stole it from
No, I bought the
wrong.
Thing that they seldom made.
Yeah.
They're not really expensive. They make them different sizes.
Like $100.
They work fantastic. I mean, yeah. I use Genelec.
That was like $4.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you totally beat me on that.
But it's true, especially like Genelecs have a bunch of little dip switches on the back that
yep.
are voodoo to most people, but they're actually not that complicated.
Right.
But a Genelec sitting on a table, which is how I had mine when I first got them.
Right.
And I'm sorry to say this to the Genelec people, but I still like the older generation of Genelecs
Absolutely.
More than the newer.
Yep.
Yeah, I do. But...
You're talking about the big ones or the small ones?
The, like the 8-inch and the 10-inch.
1031s.
1031As and those kinds of things. I mean, matched with a great sub from them. I don't know. I have both. I have the
me
new
too.
And the old.
I went from the 831 to the 840,
mm-hmm.
which is the corresponding model.
Mm-hmm.
I heard a big difference. The high-end and everything. I've been using Genelecs in probably 85% of the studios where I worked,
yeah.
different sizes and everything. And I always liked the sound, but the new generation of speakers, they sounded better to me.
I mean,
define better.
Well, it was
better
more
clear,
and I heard more details that I didn't hear before.
Because I think on the old ones versus the new ones, it's for me it was the low end and what was happening down there that really attracted me to the old ones. As opposed to new
I didn't
ones.
Really hear a difference in the low end. I perceived a difference in the high end. I felt like a difference of clarity between the two models.
I mean, they're very different.
It might have been the positioning
chassis.
And everything.
Well, Genelecs are very, very sensitive
oh,
to
yeah.
how they're set up, to the furniture, to the room.
No, I did the thing with the angles and everything,
mm-hmm.
but when I turned it on the first day, it was like, this is very interesting.
I don't know. I don't know if it's the wood versus the metal or what, but I
yeah.
just think the old ones sound a little bit warmer.
I spent 8 years on every day mixing post on the old ones, and they were – maybe it's because I was so familiar with the sound, but
I
got to
I probably
the
spent
other
the same
ones,
amount of time with the old generations too, but now I get
I spent 8 years and 4 months, 3 days, 14 hours.
Wow.
Let me say wow.
Drag.
No, because you're the man.
I go back and forth between the old and new ones all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't know, for our main mixing, I still go back to the old ones.
But you know what? You brought up a good point, though.
And, I always do.
And that's, speakers are pretty subjective, you know? And
completely.
And if you find a speaker that you like and it works for you, stick with it and get to know it. Because I think just... learning to listen to on your own monitors as opposed to always trying to look for the next newest thing, always trying to swap out speakers. I have a friend of mine who's a musician. It must be a bi-monthly thing where he gets new speakers.
Really?
You know, I mean, all the time I walk into the guy's studio. He always
doesn't
has
even
new
have
speakers.
The time to
well,
learn the reference.
Learn them,
exactly.
Yeah.
You don't know how to reference. And somehow he's thinking that the speaker is going to make him a better mixer. And it's like, you know,
mm-hmm.
you can mix on – you know, two small little drivers hooked up, you know, from a headphone. You just need to learn more about the craft of mixing as opposed to trying to find the crutches of, you know, it's going to be the speaker that's going to make me sound better. It's going to be.
You know what else? I think I said this like 50 shows ago or something, but it's not true of all gadgets in the audio industry, but with speakers, it kind of is true that expensive usually means better.
Mm-hmm.
Not always, but usually. And that's not true of a lot of other
toys
that we use, but. generally, more expensive speaker is better.
I mean, you can tell. It's just...
it just works out that way. I mean, and it's always kind of been the rule. Even with home speakers, for whatever reason. It's not the case with amplifiers and with instruments. There's a whole bunch of things it's not true with. But with speakers, it just kind of works out
that way. Now, do you think, like, a $5,000 speaker versus a $2,500 speaker? Is that...
That starts to become about taste.
Is it going to be, like, stages? I mean,
but in the case of the Genelex, you can tell the difference.
You can. It becomes diminishing returns. Okay. I mean, like, a $70,000 speaker versus an $80,000 speaker, it's personal taste.
Right. Yeah, you're right.
But, yeah, a $2,500 versus $5,000, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, like, my main 5-1, or actually 7-1 setup for mixing is all bigger Genelex.
Right.
And I've done the exact same setup with just one size down.
Right.
And it's apples and oranges. Yeah. I mean, we could never work with the smaller ones, and the bigger ones are just perfect.
Yeah.
So, and it wasn't that huge of a price difference, but it was a price difference, over generation versus new. Yeah, 2,500 to 5,000, that's 2-1. That's a big difference.
Yeah.
But like 9,000 versus 10,000, that's personal taste.
That's interesting.
It just turns out to be true, I mean, just from experience with
someone. So I should tell my friend, save his money and just buy a great stinking speaker.
You know what, there's something wrong. You can't even learn your own speakers in 2 months.
No,
so
but you know what, it's all part of the
What if the problem is with the room?
No, well, that's true, too.
Because you might have a...
Does he move every 2 months, too?
No, and you know what, it may not be every 2 months, but it's really... He really goes through a lot of speakers. And I just think it's the symptom that's even broader, where people try to buy into their talent. They try to, buy the latest and greatest keyboard.
It's just misdirected.
Because they want the cool sound and they think it's going to make them the cool keyboard
speakers
player.
Speakers are still one of those things that you've got to learn.
In our main room, and, my business partner, Gary, is a multi Grammy-winning mixer and everything else. We've been using the same speakers for 15 years.
Yeah.
Because there's nothing wrong with them. They sounded great 15 years ago. They still sound great. We've had to replace some drivers and stuff over the years as things have just worn out from age, but there's absolutely no reason to change them. And we know these speakers so well that we know instantly in a mix how things are going to translate to every other set of speakers.
No, and
you got to know that.
That's a great point. If you can become familiar with your gear so that you, not so much that you know it when things are right, but you know it when things are wrong. You're like, you know what? I can hear a chord. Something's wrong with it. That's not supposed to be right. Or something's, there's
also,
a pot.
You should pick speakers that are close to the kind of music that you do mostly. Because, for example, I do a lot of stuff for films, trailers and stuff.
Right.
And Genelex work well for that.
No,
they give me the experience that I need.
No,
and so
right.
I just kept using them because of that reason.
And if Scott was here, he'd say Dyne Audio.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
Other brands. There are plenty of really good ones.
Yeah.
But the trick is, whatever you have, learn it. Just know it inside and out. Know the way it translates to other speakers. Because really, you're not mixing for your own speakers. You're mixing for every other set of speakers on earth.
That's true, too. Yeah, that's right. That's the last point is, speakers are one of the things that you are mixing basically to play back an environment that's never going to be like you're mixing in right then.
Right,
exactly.
So, all right. Well, there we go. From headphones to speakers. Well, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to visit with Brian Mann and talk about animation and composing for animation. So we'll see you on the other side.
You're listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Apex and Westwave Audio. Have a question for the panel? Would you like to be a guest on the Audio Nowcast and live in the LA area? Email us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Audio Nowcast. And before the break, we were talking about headphones, Rob's favorite subject.
Absolutely. Love them.
And monitors. And it was really a great discussion. And I think we pretty much covered both those subjects pretty well.
I would say so.
So let's move on. Joining us today on the podcast is Brian Mann from Man-Made Music. And I've worked with Brian on, like I said at the opening, probably on about a dozen animated programs for kids. We did Leapfrog, Letter Factory and the Word Factory and the Storybook Factory and a bunch of factories. And the thing I noticed that what I really liked about working with Brian's stuff is his music was not only very theatrical and was just a really good score, but he also did a lot of really cool musical effects that saved me a ton of work, you know? And so I wanted to bring him on so that we can talk about a little bit about animation and how scoring for animation is a little bit different than doing live action, mainly because of the musical effects that you use and how music actually molds a lot of the personality of a lot of the characters, gets defined with the music. But Brian, let's just start and tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got started and some of the things you've worked on.
Well, first, all of those DVDs and shows, I work with Craig Dobbin as my partner, and we pretty much divide everything up and work together on it. We started working together about 8 or 10 years ago, whenever JJ the Jet Plane started.
Right.
And a friend of mine was involved with that, and he asked me if I'd be interested in doing the score. He wanted to write the songs. And I had just met Craig, and we had had a meeting of composers in Santa Barbara. And I said, well, who else are you talking to? And he said, well, I'm talking to Craig Dobbin about doing it. I said, well, why don't you have both of us do it? And I think I was trying to increase – I'd rather have half of something than all of nothing, you know, so I thought my chances were better. And it also was kind of an ethos that I was following, you know, about sharing the work and growing that way. And so Craig and I started working on JJ and composing the scores for those shows. We did 40 episodes, and it's been running for many years, and it's been really good for us. And we went on to do other work together. And so all of this animation work that I've been doing since then has been with Craig as a partner, and it's been great. So I wanted to mention him right from the beginning.
Yeah, we can't forget Craig. Sorry, so, Craig.
Yeah. And I've been playing since I was 3 years old. My dad gave me a harmonica, and he said I didn't stop playing it, and he was trying to get me to say what it was because I wasn't talking much, you know. I was just playing a harmonica, and then he said, harmonica. My dad was really into enunciation, harmonica. And then he told me that later that I said, well, I can't say it, but I can play it.
And good enough.
Yeah, went on from there. But I grew up in a music school. My dad taught music.
Oh.
And then he went on. He later specialized in accordion because that was his instrument. So I grew up as an accordion nerd. And didn't get a lot of girls in high school, so I took up the piano and keyboards and got my first break in 1977 with Kenny Loggins. I auditioned for him, and I was part of his first band after he left Messina.
Really?
Yeah. And we did 4 records and all platinum and worked with Stevie Nicks and toured with Fleetwood Mac. And
were you on the Live from the Santa Barbara Bowl?
Yeah. That's me there with long hair.
I've never seen that. That was like one of the first laser discs that came out.
That's right.
I just remember at the store they were playing that all the time, and uh-huh. It was a good concert, good show.
It was a good show. Those were good days, and then that sort of got me known as a musician, and I wrote some songs with Kenny also, and I'm really grateful he gave me a good start.
Wow.
And went on to play with a lot of different people, but he gave me a start and got into studio work in the 80s in Los Angeles when there were studios, and I'm well,
and
there were more,
yeah, and there was work.
Studios, yeah. Work.
And then got into writing jingles later on, and that's how I got to start as a composer. I'd studied composition at USC and Fullerton, and I had degrees and stuff. But that was my first paid work writing, was for commercials, and did a lot of car commercials and things and for years, and then moved to Santa Barbara, and is a little harder to get work. So first, the children's work came along, and I love it. I just grew up loving watching a lot of cartoons and loving them and loving the Disney movies and those scores. So I think when I sit down to write, my fallback position is I try to recreate the feeling that I had watching those movies as a kid and try to create that for kids now. And so I want to bring the warmth and the comfort so that when the kids are watching these, they feel good, because we know how music affects our feelings. And so it's a love thing. I love it. I love what I do, and I'm not that picky about the work as long as I get to make music and sometimes get paid. And
that's a bother.
Yeah. So I have a nice life up in Santa Barbara. So it's all balanced. I'm not quite as career oriented as I was when I was younger, I've noticed, but it's working out great.
Well, you know, it's funny you said that about the warmth in your scores, because that's one thing I always mentioned to the producer that I worked with that we know together, and that your music is very it's very warm, and especially with the kids and a lot of the slower parts, there's this certain kind of like getting a musical hug, you know, and it's funny that you say that, because it totally comes across in your music.
Thank you.
One thing that I wanted to ask you is when you start a project, and let's go for the first time you see the script, or do you see the script or you see the first cut? I mean, how far in advance do they bring you in on some of these?
Yeah, we usually do see a script.
Okay.
And we usually ignore it. And I don't mean to sound cynical or facetious.
Right.
It's just that we've been burned so many times with the script because, well, what they wind up with usually is very different. It looks and feels different than when I read the script.
I got you.
I'm interpreting the written word and feeling it. And when the pictures come back, it's a different feeling. The tone is different.
Right,
and
right.
I've never seen it be real close.
Right.
So in the beginning, we were very ambitious, and we'd start writing themes, you know, from the script. And they want that, you know, the reassurance. And it's counterproductive at this point, because you get stuck with things that now you have to try to make work.
I got you.
With the picture that they're not second nature to
right.
the picture.
So basically you wait till you see some of the animation. Although some of the stuff like where your music is part of the story, like with some of the like the songs for the letters and
right.
things like that, you have to be brought on early enough.
Yeah, we pre-score. There's pre-score and post-score, and nowadays we're writing a lot of most of the songs or all of the songs for the DVDs and shows, and so that's done ahead of time. And there's a whole, you know, what I've noticed that was surprising to me when we started doing that was a lot of times in the script there's just the hole for the song,
right?
And there's not much given to us as far as what's the action during that song, what are we supposed to carry through there. And so basically we're writing the 2 or 3 minutes of script,
right?
And
as a song,
right?
That's interesting.
And that surprised me. I didn't realize. And so there's we have to think about the show in the same way that the writers do,
right.
of the story at that point. And now we've recognized that. We talked about it with the producers ahead of time. They acknowledge that. And then we have a lot of back and forth with them and the money people or whoever's else involved in decision making, because we're writing the story there.
Right.
And the script has already gone through many rewrites,
right.
and so forth. But that 3-minute hole here, that 2-minute hole there,
right.
is just, well, there'll be a song there. Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting, too, is your lyrics have to stay true to what the character would say. And, you know, I've never felt like when I was mixing some of your stuff that the story came along and then, you know, the song came and the character took a U-turn. It's always been very consistent.
Do they supply you with lyrics or are you writing lyrics?
Most of the time we write the lyrics. Usually we will beg for input because it's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah.
And so we try to, like, one producer that we work with quite a bit, he has a lot of good ideas for lyrics, so he'll just throw off a list of things, and we usually try to use that, both because the idea, he's been working on this, developing this show for a year. He knows the ins and outs and what they're trying to achieve with it. So I really want that input from him. And of course, when we're writing the songs, we do read the scripts very carefully,
right,
and try to find as much in there as we can. The actors are quite a, voice actors are very largely responsible also for the tone and character, the carrying through the character's voice,
right,
and tone. And when we do, as you know, when we do voice sessions, there's always a reference. You know, so the voice actors have recorded the dialogue maybe months before. Now, we've written the songs, they've gotten approved, so we go into a session to record the same actors singing their parts. Well, it's been months since they did that character voice, and so there's always a reference played, of the character from dialogue so that they can recreate that same thing and have it be true. So they're really a big part of having that cohesiveness. But it's fun. I mean, it's fun to be able to write some drama, you know, and to get involved in that too. I love it.
Right.
It's very interesting.
Now let me ask you a question. So you've got the script, you see the QuickTime. Where do you start developing the musical personalities of the different characters? Because if there's one thing I've noticed on a lot of stuff we worked with, each character has its kind of its little theme and kind of has its little, you know, a little personality. Even the way they walk, you really do a great job in giving each character its little musical personality. How do you do that? How does that come across? Is it just like, hey, we're going to try this? Or what's the process for defining their musical characters?
Craig and I, like when we started with JJ, there was a set of recurring characters. There was a cast of animated characters, the different airplanes and a helicopter. And so we decided to take the motif approach of using motifs for each character and a particular instrument if possible. So when Jay, and I think we, looking back, we probably carried it to an extreme and came prisoners of it a little bit, but every time JJ would come on, it would be clarinet, so forth. And with the old crusty airplane, it was a bassoon. And things like that. And so these identify was, you know, Peter and the Wolf, is a great example of that, of using themes and instruments, you know, to represent the different characters. And that's just, you know, to me is my Bible is that score and that music.
Do you record actual musicians or you just sample?
Well, I like to think that
because the clarinet and the bassoon are so.
I know. I used to have that luxury with the commercials. Believe it or not, had bigger budgets, but we don't have the budget. So it's all hopefully as artful as possible using samples.
In these days, I mean, they're pretty.
Especially clarinet and bassoon, you can get away with it.
Exactly.
Wouldn't want to try a violin.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Solo violin's a rough one.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you do, and so, good point. It has shaped the instruments that we use, or the ones that are more convincing, mm-hmm, you know, from samples and otherwise. And we've gotten so used to doing that. And we're so quick with it that the idea of, okay, now bringing in a live orchestra, it's a little daunting to think of spending that much time translating
for them.
Yeah,
it would take a lot of time, yeah.
But sonically, it would be much better.
But see, I think that's the reason why I want to talk about it is I think that's a point where a lot of young composers that are, you know, starting off, they don't realize, especially when they're doing animation, you know, how much of a personality you can give it by doing, listening to something as simple as, you know, Peter and the Wolf and just copying some of those techniques that work so well and giving the piece the character. Because the music, I will say that I've worked on some projects where your music has totally lifted the quality of the whole production. Because animation is, you know, they're getting cheaper and cheaper. They're doing, instead of, you know, 24 frames, they're going to be doing 15 frame animation and, you know, and 10 frames, you know, walk cycles and things like that. And so you get some good music up there, it's definitely going to bring up the quality of, mm-hmm. of what you see, you know. And I think that's one thing. If you're out there and you want to be a composer, you should start looking at some of these, the cartoons that are out there, and start looking at some of the children's animated things and notice how the music.
Most likely
is
the first
character.
Music you ever hear when you,
yeah.
you know,
right.
when you, when your first approach with music and stories, you know.
Right.
Now, let me ask you about, we've got the character, we've got the songs. Now, what about the little musical sound effects that you throw in there?
Oh, yeah.
How do
yeah.
those come in?
Yeah.
Is that the producer saying that, or is that you're saying it? I'm saying thank you.
But, well, no, that's such a good point, because I remember you saying thank you years ago, and because I started wondering, is this person doing the sound effects going to be really irritated with me for doing so much? Well, I think it started because I like doing it. It's fun. And I just remember the Mickey Mouse cartoons and the Warner Brothers cartoons and Hanna-Barbera and all the effects. And I just love that stuff, the
right.
musical effects.
Right.
And I kind of wanted to learn it. I wanted to develop a vocabulary of musical effects. And so, again, I probably did more than I needed to do. And what I'm learning is, from experience, being able to look at a certain action and decide for myself, is that better with sound effects
right.
or music? So I'm kind of producing myself in a way, or music directing myself, you know, at that point to decide. I've had enough experience to take a good guess now. But there's also some rules of thumb. Craig and I just worked on a show on PBS and another animated children's show. And it takes place in a kindergarten, and the kids go home to make a musical instrument. So they're making a cigar box, or, you know, guitar and a kazoo out of toilet paper and things like that. So every scene is going to have them playing this thing, making it and playing it. Now, I called the sound effects guy, and Patrick, and I asked him, what are we going to do here? Because at some point there's a one-man band who's playing all these things, and the kids are playing nothing. I said, I think this is music, not sound effects. Well, I've already done all the sound effects, he said. So he sent me the files for the sound effects, and I listened to them, and I thought, well, I'll just pull them in, sample them, and use those to create music. What I wound up doing was it was a compromise. I let certain things go, and then when they were playing together. But the rule of thumb for me is there a discernible rhythm? Is there a repeating pattern or a rhythm? And if so, then to me it needs to be music. It
right.
should be music. Yeah. And things like that.
Versus synced sound effects that don't really give you
yeah.
the sense of
don't give a
pattern.
So,
right.
so a slip and fall can be music, and I love to do those. And it can be some kind of a whistle.
Right.
You know? So I mean, we've gotten direction where we want this cartoony, or we don't want it cartoony.
Right.
We want it filmic. And so, you know, and how much Mickey Mousing you do is another larger judgment to make, and it's all, you know, it's taste. It's my version is my version. Somebody else do it different.
But from the mixer's perspective, like when I would get your music, and then a couple times you actually split off your musical sound effects from the music stems, and I had
mm-hmm.
I had control over those. It was just a nice blend, a nice way, because I'd
That's
throw
right.
my hard effects up against your musical effects, and you know, it sounds cartoony. It sounds like the way animation should sound for what we were going for, you know, and especially things like when you want to add a little bit of intensity, but on a kid-friendly, almost comedic
right.
point of view, it really kind of softens the edge of like an intense chase scene where you have a little bit of the musical funny coming through with the hard effects, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked on a We worked on a Halloween, kids Halloween thing, and that was the key because we're doing all these sound designs of like skeletons and, you know, and ghosts, and it was Sleepy Hollow and,
right.
you know, the horsemen and that whole thing. And, you know, we don't want to freak out.
No, it can't be
you know, so it was really nice to have Brian's music come in to kind of soften the blow so
That's
that
true.
The kids aren't all open eyed looking like, you know, and you got like, you know, I remember that one with,
yes,
with like the mummy and stuff. And it's just, it was just a really good way to soften the blow. And I think if you're, you know, if you're working on these kid things and you're working on, you know, animation, you really got to pay attention to that kind of thing. You got to pay attention to your audience. You got to, you know, not everything has to sound like a gigantic, you know, horror film feature.
Not
you know,
course,
sometimes yeah. you need to tone it down, or at least sound like it's toned down. I mean, it was a huge session, but well, Brian, you do such a great job over at Man Made Music on putting the whole thing together. When you're done with these, with the whole package, and it's mm-hmm. time to go in, how do you deliver? Do you deliver split stems, or do you give them just a mix? I mean, what's
you know, most of the time it's mix. Yeah, for the songs it's always split. Of course, the vocal.
Right.
I shouldn't say of course, but the vocals on a separate track. There's a lot of times there's a foreign language. They're going
right.
to be foreign language.
Right.
You know, vocals.
And, yeah, like on the we did the Letter Factory together, and all those songs are that's in. I forget how many different languages, yeah. but I know they've put in a ton of different languages.
Yeah.
Hey, Rob, have you done any animation? Have you done any animated programs?
I have, actually. I've done a bunch. Actually, it's funny we're talking about this animation tonight because we discovered this week on YouTube, it's the weirdest thing. A long time ago, I don't even remember when it was, sometime in the 90s, I wrote the theme song for Sonic the Hedgehog for the cartoon.
Ah.
And... it kind of was a huge hit all around the world, you know, a very popular cartoon. Well, for some reason, a whole bunch of people have started doing covers of the theme song, and they're on YouTube. And Gary, my partner, was showing me the other day. He looked it up, and there's all these people. And, like, there's this one kid playing guitar and singing. There's another one who just does it singing only. But there's a lot of videos of people covering the Sonic the Hedgehog theme.
Awesome.
I mean, that has to be, like, 15 years ago or something.
You know what? Video game music is making a comeback.
But it's funny because it's been so long. I mean, I kind of remembered the song. But to hear these kids singing every word and every verse, like, they didn't even use every verse in the show. We had written it as a longer song. Somehow they found it, though.
Can you hum a few bars?
I cannot. I cannot. But it's a YouTube viral hit.
Oh, shit.
Have you guys seen the guy on YouTube who recreated Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon, all on an NES using 8-bit sound or whatever it is?
No.
Yeah.
No.
I heard something.
We'll have to check it out.
It's posted on my Facebook page if anyone's there. But it's
are you promoting your Facebook page?
Yes. Facebook page.
Wow, look, Brandon all of a sudden has 45 new members.
You're right.
But you know what? As far as like working on animated series and stuff,
right.
It really is kind of like who you know. Well, it's not just animated series. It's any kind of work in the audio business. It's kind of who you know to build a relationship. Because if you're going to do episodic work of any kind, there has to be a comfort factor. And that means you have to have a relationship with the clients.
That's true.
And our relationships in the early days just didn't happen to line up with animated series. We got called to do a bunch of music, like songs for animation. We actually did a ton of stuff for Disney for years, doing a lot of the international versions of some of their features, you know, like recording The Little Mermaid in Japanese and that kind of stuff. We did that, and we did covers of a lot of their songs and some original songs. And so we did a lot of music that was tied in with animation, but never actually a series. It just never came to us. We never had any connections for it. And it's who you know, and it is amazing how many people are clamoring for, you know, reduced budgets and,
right.
and reduced schedules and everything else. But it's still a great kind of creative expression. If you can fall in with the right clients, it's a really good way to be able to express yourself.
It's if you can get it, it's good work. I mean, technology definitely has helped in the whole composing, mixing for picture, especially now with QuickTimes going back and forth as opposed to a recorder going back and forth.
It's a huge difference for me and for just working to QuickTime instead of tape.
Well, it means you can live in Santa Barbara for one thing. You're not
carriers. I was supporting FedEx for years.
I'm sure.
And a courier.
And a courier, yeah.
Back in those days when the tapes had to go back and forth. Yeah, the DA-88s. And the,
yeah. We used to set aside hundreds of dollars a month for couriers. Mm-hmm. And that's just completely gone.
Yeah.
Completely gone.
And the good thing with QuickTimes, too, is QuickTimes allow you to work on, like, your laptop and not have to worry about time code because, you know, you can keep sync. And that's a big one, man.
Yeah.
That is a big one, keeping the sync, because there was nothing more depressing than having a session. You get the tape, and then the session isn't in sync because it's a drop frame tape, and it's a non-drop frame, and somebody did this, and there's a pull
time
down
of
here,
just rewinding and everything. Just
right,
and then
right.
It starts in the
instant location.
Yeah.
The synchronization thing as a composer used to be this huge thing. I mean, Earl Hagen's course at BMI was almost the whole course was about.
Same.
You know, the book of frame rates and as opposed equations with tempo and all that. So I learned all that stuff, but it took so much time just to find those sync points that the composing you couldn't do today that on the deadlines that we work with now.
Oh, yeah.
You could
mm-hmm.
not get it done. Just it wouldn't
that
happen.
That's true.
You could do it with a kazoo, you know, like,
right.
You know, but other than that.
Nothing you'd want to ever have to conduct. I mean, it was impossible to do a good tempo track or master track.
You know, another good thing about working in animation is, although there still are changes, there aren't as many changes late in the game in animation.
Well, they're not going to, like, usually create a whole scene and
exactly.
Cut it because
exactly.
It's just too expensive and too
exactly.
Much work.
You know, because that's the other like nightmare thing is when you get the final and you line up your sound effects and wait a second, why does that guy walk in and sound like a door slam? Something's going on there. You know? But wow. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us and just letting us in on a little bit of what goes on composing for children's animation.
Thank you.
I must ask you, what platform do you work on?
Macintosh. Digital Performer.
Yeah. Great. What version do you work on? Do you have the latest one?
Yeah. Well, there's 7.2 now, which has, and I've got the iPhone app now that I can remote control from my iPhone.
Don't say Mike these things because he's got everything. I mean, he's got everything.
Stop. They do make an iPad controller for Digital Performer.
Okay, now we're starting talking about iPad.
No,
we're gone.
It's pretty awesome.
It's always like this.
Sorry.
I didn't know the rule.
I
tried to warn you, but sorry. Don't worry about it.
You know what? You're just jealous.
You see how naturally it just switches to the Apple mode.
So Digital Performer, and you've been with it since?
Since Performer 1.
Wow.
You know,
have you tried anything else before?
I tried...
What's the
German
Logic? Cubase.
Logic.
Cubase years ago, and it didn't. You know what? For scoring, DP always had better timing apps within it. You know, for mapping tempos and hit points and things like that. Then I tried Logic, and the learning curve was just too daunting for me because I'm so fast with DP. It's just
Rob likes Logic, so.
Incorrect.
Craig uses Logic, and you know, and I think you know, there's a lot of nice plugins for it. But I don't know it,
right.
Know it well. You don't like it, huh?
No, I do like the plugins for it, but it's a horrifically designed piece of software.
The interface
it's very buggy and very just in need of a complete rewrite.
Don't hold back, Rob.
I won't.
Come on, don't. Hey, do you use a lot of soft synths, or do you have a mini rig, or?
Both. Well, I have a few PCs that run Giga Studio, which is now defunct in a way. But I developed templates for orchestra, which I'm, you know, they're there and they still like the sounds. But I'm using more and more soft synths in the, you know, especially for pop or rock oriented, you know, things with all of the Stylus R Mix and right. Trillion and good. Omnisphere. And then all the NI stuff and a lot of plugins.
Giga Studio, did you get the 3.0? Do you have it?
I have two of the PCs are in 3.0. Yeah, and one's still back in the other one.
I like backups, you know, for the old stuff.
That Giga Studio was such a nice sounding sampler. I mean, it sounded great. And especially with the convolution reverb and the way you can place your orchestra and place the instruments wherever you want. I mean, it was just a brilliant, brilliant program until Tascam killed it. Like Gibson killed Opcode. But, wow, well, that's great. That's really cool. You know, speaking of software and DAWs and things like that, Rob, we got a user question that you got to answer.
Okay.
And it has to do with, it actually was posted on our discussion forum.
Bye.
So Robert Weber posted in our discussion forum, and see, we do read these things, people. He was talking about, I've been listening to old shows since there don't seem to be too many new ones. Okay, that's a rip on me.
You take it, man.
I just listened to an episode from early 2007 where two of the guys, Rob and Scott, that was actually probably Rob and Bobby, make really strong arguments for Cubase as the DAW of choice.
That's better than Ableton.
For people working with a lot of MIDI. I was wondering, now that Pro Tools 8 and the new Logic Studio are out, if their opinions have changed at all. Rob, has your opinions changed at all?
My opinions have changed. Slightly. Slightly. I mean, first, let's get Logic out of the way. Basically, they did. They came out with a whole new version number. That was exciting. The basic MIDI foundation has all the same problems it ever had. Just try to run Logic with a little bit of non-standard hardware and a little bit of funny driver stuff going on, and you'll find that compared to every other sequencer, it's the buggiest thing you will ever encounter. And the underlying MIDI and the underlying editing for MIDI controllers and just the audio integration and the waveform display and just all the basics of it are just very, very archaic and need to be rewritten from scratch. Every version that comes out, they heap some new features on, which are usually great, but that doesn't fix the underlying stuff that really needs to be rewritten. And I use Logic for the plugins. It comes with some great instruments, some great effects. It definitely has some merit, but as a workstation and a sequencer, it's just horrific. I usually say that the reason people use it is because they don't know anything better. And, most people don't have time to learn something else if they're getting their work done, and I understand that. But if you really take the time to learn all the major pieces of DAW software out there, you'll realize what you've been missing. The new version of Cubase is great. The old version was great. The new version added some stuff. You know, they come out with a lot of features that I didn't really miss before they existed because I was able to get all my work done. But, you know, it was all incremental upgrades. They came out with some new instruments and some new plugins and stuff. And Cubase continues to be pretty easy to learn and pretty much rock solid. It has its bugginess, too, from time to time, but it's pretty solid. The biggest surprise for me is how much Pro Tools' MIDI has come along. And a couple months ago, I did a piece of music for the World's Fair in Shanghai and for the U.S. Pavilion. And actually, Scott Gershon's company, Soundlux DMG, did the some of the sound design work, and we did some of the music. And I decided as an experiment to sequence the whole thing in Pro Tools. And it was a post-score. You know, we got some video to score, you know, practically every bar, a different time signature, tempo change, all these different hit points we had to hit, really like a sophisticated score like we do for a film or something. And I was shocked at how great all of the hit point stuff in Pro Tools has become. It may be the most intuitive, easiest one to use.
It's very basic, but it works.
And it's not even as basic anymore. Well, it's pretty good.
Well, compared to Logic, you understand it right away. Logic.
Well, it's so much simpler. Basic in that sense, absolutely. It's just, it's, well, I always say Logic is the most ironically named piece of software ever created.
I agree. But you remember at the beginning people didn't like the meeting Pro Tools, and I liked it because I started.
It was okay.
Yeah, but it wasn't bad, you know.
But
as
it's gotten,
it was bad.
compared to something really good, I thought it was bad. But for this,
but I said at the beginning anyway.
In the beginning, but talking about where things are now, Pro Tools MIDI has really come of age. There are a few things about it that I thought were a little quirky, just from a feature kind of way, the way they implemented certain things. But overall, it was pretty great, and I was able to get through this whole project, and it ended up being a pretty complicated score. Got through the whole thing in Pro Tools, and there's something incredibly elegant about having, all the MIDI in with all of your audio, because it ended up being hundreds of tracks, and, we're mixing it on the D control, so it's all laid out, and we're scrolling faders around, and it was really cool having all of the MIDI and all of the audio in one system. And I never have synchronization problems between external Cubase and Pro Tools and all that stuff. So it's not like we needed it all in one box for synchronization reasons.
Right.
It was a really good sequencer, and the editing was pretty good, and it's gotten very powerful, the way you can see multiple controller lanes, and the timing is phenomenal, and the lock between audio and MIDI is sample accurate, and it's really, really good. Yep. So wow. I was surprised. I expect each new version of Cubase to be that much better than the previous one. It's not too often they actually ruin something. It's usually made better and better. But I was surprised that I was able to do everything I did in Pro Tools. It was pretty good.
Wow.
So if you are going to be using Pro Tools and you don't want to have a bunch of computers, I don't personally like running too many different pieces of software on any one machine. I'd rather add more machines. It's just less problematic. So if you want to be able to do everything in the box, there's nothing wrong with doing all your MIDI and Pro Tools.
Oh, I love it too.
There we go. Answered that.
Yeah.
I can tell you
what Bobby would say. Actually, he has been pulled a little bit more to the Pro Tools side to realizing how cool it's gotten.
Wow.
He was always very reluctant. He still sequences as I do, mostly in Cubase.
Right.
Because power-wise, Pro Tools doesn't even pretend to be the kind of powerful sequencer that Cubase or Logic pretends to be.
Right.
Or Performer is. And I have a lot of friends who use Digital Performer, especially for TV scoring.
Yeah, me too.
It's rock solid. I personally do not have the eyesight to be able to see that many little minuscule fonts on the gigantic screen.
They are too small.
They are way too small.
I've been
they have
asking
been,
them to.
You're not alone.
But it's an artistic
I realize,
choice.
Yeah. It's a powerful piece of software, though. And, Motu tends to stay pretty current with the trends. When something needs to be rewritten, they do rewrite it. I don't think that Logic is a big enough priority at Apple to ever actually make it what it could be. I think they're just going to keep building on it. I think compared to the amount of money that Apple makes from, iPhones and iPods and stuff, Logic is barely a blip on the radar. And
yeah, probably less than half.
Yeah, you're probably
yeah,
right.
Yeah, less than half of a percent. I mean, it's nothing to them compared to, selling millions of iPads. But, I have plenty of friends who've done huge stuff in Logic and made hit records, and, they could have all done those records in other better software, but there's nothing, it doesn't mean, it all comes down to the operator, not the software. You can hear a great guitarist go and pick up a $50 toy guitar in a store and they can make you cry with it. Or you can have a friend who buys a new pair of speakers every 2 months thinking that's why his mixes don't sound good. It comes down to the person more than the gear. It really does.
But the quality, right. So the bounce quality of Logic.
Well, any sequencer that you know how to use well, you should stick with it for now and worry about the music. That's my bottom line, grizzled.
Well, thank you, Rob, for answering that question.
It's my pleasure. What else you got?
I will never get another question from Robert again.
No. I'm giving him good news.
No, you are. You are.
You're get a cheap Pro Tools LE, do your MIDI in there, and call it a day.
Well, hey, listen, this show has gone on way too long.
We're in day four.
It's been really good. We've covered a lot of things. Brian, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Thank you for all the insight on that. And before we go, Rob, you have anything you can talk about? Make it fast.
I have stuff I can almost talk about. We actually just finished a really big TV campaign, a national commercial campaign, which I can't talk about officially until it's actually aired, which right. I think is going to be in the next couple weeks. Actually, I don't know when this podcast is going to post, but probably be around the same time. But it was a huge national campaign for us, kind of got us back into product commercials. I will give one hint. The commercial has mannequins in it. But I don't want to say too much because I don't know what I'm allowed to say, but it turned out really great. I know the final version has shipped, so it's a done deal. And wow. It's just a really exciting thing to be back doing product spots because it's not something we have done for quite a while.
Great. Brian, you working on anything that you can talk about? Anything coming out?
Yeah. So Craig Dobbin and Don McManus is someone we're working on developing a TV show for kids, and can't talk too much about that.
That's a tradition here. On the
yeah. This part. Yeah, we get more of not talks than talks.
Yeah, really. Sit around and not talk about stuff.
Yeah, because I get emails on that all the time. Why can't you guys talk about this stuff? It's like, well, because we don't want to get sued. Brandon, what about you? Are you working on anything?
Well, I think I can say these because they're in TV campaigns already, but still working on The Town a little bit, Legend of the Guardians, and I won't say the one that's still in teaser trailer.
Yeah, anything that's on the air is.
How about you, Diego? I know you got a lot up your sleeve that you can't talk about.
No, but I can tell you something. I'm working on bringing Music from a Tree live. So nice. I am basically trying to find the best system to do it live, and obviously I think it's going to be Ableton Live because it's just a phenomenal piece of software. Yep. And I just started using it. I love it. It's going to take me, a few days to get used to it because coming from many years of Pro Tools, but I love it. And also I have to build, just bought yesterday, 5 new stethoscopes to customize. And so I'm going to have to build the stethoscopes. I'm going to have to customize the contact mics because I have to build them in a certain way. And, because I was also playing some stuff from the Lemon Tree. I found some very interesting sounds. So I'm just, combining all these ideas in a way that is portable and playable live. It's going to be interesting, I guess.
I want to see the road case for the trees. That'd be cool. I've designed some cool road cases, right. But the tree one.
So if you live in Southern California and you hear someone knocking on your tree in the middle of the night.
Yes.
Don't be nervous. It's just Diego.
I'm just rehearsing.
That's great. Well, that's cool. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Me too.
And what about you, Mike?
Not much other than same stuff that I talked about last week. I've been working on some radio commercials and mixing. I'm going to be doing a music video, directing a music video, and just kind of trying to get the podcast website redesigned. I will say that we're working on that right now. We're going to be doing some stuff. I just want to right now thank everybody out there. Our downloads are blowing up. We are getting a tremendous amount of downloads, and we're going to more than double what we did last year. And it's basically because people out there download the show, and I feel really humble and really thankful that it seems to resonate with some people. And, feel free to drop us an email or, sign up on our Facebook page. We've got now 9 listeners.
Oh, my God. That is something.
But they each downloaded 600 times.
Yes.
No, but it's been really great. And I just want to thank everybody who listens and people that, comment on the Facebook page. It's really cool. And we've got some good, loyal listeners out there. And so we're going to really make an effort to, just talk to you guys and get to know you. And if you're ever in, Southern California, literally you can send me an email and we'll have you sit on in with us and,
You can see the madness live.
The madness live. So if you have a comment or question, you can reach us at audio@nowcastnetwork.com. That's audio@nowcastnetwork.com. You can also catch us on our Facebook page by just searching for Audio Nowcast, and you can become a fan. And if we get over 100 people that like us, then we can have a Facebook URL with Audio Nowcast. So,
ooh.
Oh, really?
We're at 88. We're almost there. 12 more.
Oh, gotta give something like an ice cream. Yeah. Give an ice more. Cream to those who will subscribe.
And also, I gotta say, there's still some time left at citylovemusic.com. Write a song about your favorite city, win $10,000.
Nice.
And we're up, I think, as of today, it was like 204 songs submitted.
Nice.
So, and there's some good ones and some not so good ones.
Oh.
But get in there and write a song.
And I do want to make an announcement that that's actually, just put this on your radar, people. But I think we're going to change the theme song. I think we're going to start looking for a new theme song. I wrote that like 4 years ago, and I think we're going to just see what's out there and maybe rotate a couple. So if you have an idea for a theme song for the Audio Nowcast, we'll probably post some splits of the actually, you know what? I'll just mix it down. So just if you want to start thinking about it, we're going to tell you when we're going to start accepting some submissions for that. But, you know, you'll win a place in the Audio Nowcast.
You win a place in our hearts.
In our hearts. And we will totally give you credit and not steal it too much. But yeah, so I think we're going to do something like that. Because I just, you know, there's a lot of musicians. I noticed when I've gone through our Facebook page and I've looked at some of the guys that are there. And there's a lot of talented people out there and a great range of ages and things like that. And
and if we can get them to do something for free, it's a good education about what the music business is really like.
That's right.
There you go.
Welcome to the biz.
Welcome to the biz.
But, yeah, so that's something that I think we're going to be doing.
That's cool. Crowdsourcing the theme song.
I think,
yeah,
why not?
My God.
Why not?
Should be fun. All right. Well, hey, I just want to thank everybody for listening. And thank you, Brian, for joining us. And also, I talked to Heather, and she is going to be joining us for some podcasts. So she was kind of a hit. She was going to be here tonight, but some things happened. And that she couldn't make it, but just wanted to mention that. So for myself and all the guys, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Audio Nowcast, sponsored by Aphex and Westwave Audio. The Audio Nowcast is hosted by Mike Rodriguez with Rob Arbatier, Scott Gershon, Martin Page, Andrew Sheps, and Bobby Summerfield. The program is produced by April Mastropaulo and uses Aphex's 230 Master Channel Voice Processor. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.